Okay, good morning. So nice to see all of you. As you all know, right now, racial tensions are high in the United States. We've all been disturbed by images of violence and rioting in the news and the media. And unfortunately, even here in Israel, we're not immune to racism. There have been clashes as recently as last July between the Ethiopian immigrant community here and police. And there have been unfortunate incidents in recent years. And while the world's attention has shifted or turned now towards the issue of race in the United States, I'd like to explore together with you this morning the history of the Ethiopian Jewish community and some of the halachic rulings of a number of leading poskim as to the status of Ethiopian Jews. And it's a community, some of you may know, that I'm very familiar with, a community that I'm close with. I've had the privilege of visiting Ethiopia a number of times. Most recently, this past January, I was just there in late January, leading a group of about 25 students from the UK, visiting with the Jewish community there in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia's capital, doing chesed, exploring the rich history of the Jewish community there, and as I said, leading this group. And so in addition to looking at the history of Ethiopia's Jewish community and the halachic discussion and debate surrounding the status of the Jews of Ethiopia, I'll also share with you some reflections from my visits, some thoughts, even some video that I shot there. The story of the Jews of Ethiopia is one of the most romantic stories, dramatic stories, and unfortunately tragic stories of modern history. It's a romantic story. It's a story of a community that was exiled from their land, disconnected from their people for almost 3,000 years. But it's a story of their longing, their hope. Never did they relinquish that deep bond. They clung to the belief that they would return home to their land, to Israel, to Jerusalem. And they did in the 20th century. It's a story of perseverance and commitment. They continue to follow the Torah, or the Orit, as they call it, praying in an ancient language called Gez, following their rabbis called Kesim, and clinging to the mitzvot that they had. Some of their traditions and customs, as you know, are different than the Judaism that we're familiar with because of the long years of separation, but they maintained their tradition, they maintained their faith. And they suffered for their Judaism and made sacrifices. They suffered persecution and discrimination and even forced conversions in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. We'll revisit that a little later this morning. But they maintained their connection to their land and their people. Just a little anecdote. A member of my shul here in Jerusalem was there at Ben-Gurion Airport back in 1984 to greet the first crop of Olim. And they came with nothing but the clothes on their backs and a deep faith. And he remembers carrying children from the terminal to buses to take them to Jerusalem. They had no shoes on their feet. So he, together with other volunteers, were tasked with physically picking them up and carrying them, putting them on buses to Jerusalem. And he related to me that they thought they were going to see the Holy Temple. They were being brought to Jerusalem. They thought they were going to be taken to the Beit HaMikdash. And when they learned that the temple was no longer standing, that it was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70, they began to cry and rend their garments as a sign of mourning. Incredible. I'm sure you're familiar with the Braita and Moed Katan and Daf Chavav. It says that when a person sees the Makom HaMikdash in a state of Churban, a state of destruction, they're supposed to rend their garment. It was very real for them. So it's this romantic story. It's a story of a people, a community that's reunited with their homeland and their people, their nation. It's nothing short of a modern day miracle. Perhaps the fulfillment of the prophecy of the ingathering of the exiles from the four corners of the earth, per Isaiah chapter 11. But how did they get there? How did they get to Ethiopia? So that itself is the subject of much discussion and debate. And there are really two traditions. According to one tradition, Melech Shlomo, King Solomon, and the Queen of Sheba had a child. And that child, according to this tradition, was Menelik I, King of Ethiopia. And according to this legend, Menelik travels to Jerusalem to visit with his father, King Shlomo, and Shlomo sends him back to Ethiopia with a whole group of Jewish servants who subsequently become the Jewish community of Ethiopia. Now here, I'll put on the screen a passage from Sefer Melachim. It's found in Melachim Aleph Perek Yud, 10th chapter. There's also a parallel passage in Divrei Hayamim, in chapter Tet there, in Divrei Hayamim Bet, chapter Tet, chapter 9, which describes the visit of the Queen of Sheba to Jerusalem and her interaction with Shlomo, but there's no evidence that they had a child together. So here, I'll put on the screen for you. One moment. Share screen. Okay. Nope, that's not what I want. I have a few things I'm going to share with you this morning. Okay, here we go. Okay, so you see Melachim Aleph Perek Yud here, source number one. Okay, so you have this description of this fateful meeting between Malkat Shva, the Queen of Sheba, and King Solomon. So our tradition affirms that there was this meeting between the two of them. Okay, so here, I trust you all can see the source is up at the top. Okay, so we have this meeting. It's described, Umalkat Shva Shomat et Shema Shlomo L'Shem Hashem V'Tavol L'Nasoto B'Chidot. So the Queen of Sheba heard all about King Solomon, all about his fame, his wisdom, his knowledge, and she wanted to come and test him with Chidot, with riddles. Perhaps it means philosophical questions. You know, we know that the Gemara, for example, is filled with all sorts of anecdotes of interactions between our chachamim and leading rulers of the time where they want to challenge them with all sorts of philosophical questions. So whatever it means, she had these riddles for him, these questions for him. Shlomo, of course, was chacham mikol adam. He was the wisest of all men. So here she was, and it continues and describes that she arrives in Yerushalayim with a large entourage, with camels, and all sorts of precious gifts for King Shlomo, spices and gold and precious stones. And she spoke to him about all that was in her heart, which again leads me to believe that perhaps it's more than just testing his knowledge, but she's got philosophical questions that she's grappling with because she speaks to him about all that was in her heart. She empties her heart to him, okay? And Shlomo answers every one of her questions, it says, okay? And she sees that, wow, he's so wise. She's so impressed with his wisdom, and she's impressed with the palace that he built. And she sees the food that he serves at his tables, and she sees his servants and his attendants. Okay, she's impressed by all of the wealth there. And by the way, the Navi here also mentions the Mikdash. Okay, you know, she visits the Mikdash perhaps. She sees at least the passageway that he would ascend to the Mikdash through, okay? And she was overwhelmed. It says she's overwhelmed by his wisdom and by all that she sees there, okay? She's completely taken aback, and she's overwhelmed, the Navi describes. And then she says to him, wow, you know, it's true. It's true. I didn't believe what I had heard, but now I believe it when I've seen it with my own eyes. I heard you were wise. I heard about your kingdom. But now that I've seen it with my own eyes, I believe it. And she blesses him. Fortunate are your men who serve you, who stand before you. And then she gives him a bracha, you know, almost like a Hasidish Rebbe. She gives him a bracha. in Pasuk Tet here, in verse 9, Yehi Hashem Elokecha Baruch Asher Chafetz Becha Letitcha Al Kisei Yisrael Be'ava Hashem Et Yisrael Le'olam Vayasimcha Lemelech Lasot Mishpat Utzdaka. Right? So she says, may Hashem, your God, be blessed, who's chosen you to place you upon the throne of Israel. In Hashem's everlasting love for Israel, he has established you as king. Beautiful bracha. And then it continues that she gives Shlomo these gifts. She gave him 120 talents of gold and spices and precious stones. And there was never again such a large quantity of spice, you know, as that which the queen of Sheba gave to Shlomo. Okay, so you have this interaction between the two of them that's being described here in Sefer Melachim, Melachim Aleph Perek Yud, and then a parallel passage here in Divrei Hayamim, Bet Perek Tet. Okay? But no description that they got married, no discussion that they had a child. Okay, that is subject to legend. That's mere legend. That's this tradition that somehow they had a child together. And in Ethiopian history and Ethiopian lore, that tradition is very popular, and that tradition is very important. It's important because it gives their kings a certain yichus, for lack of a better word, a certain lineage. Or patrimony. They descend from King Shlomo. In fact, all the way till Haile Selassie, they talk about their Solomonic kings. From Menelik I to Haile Selassie, they talk about their kings and their rulers who descended from King Shlomo. So it gives them a certain esteem that they descend from Shlomo. And you see that it's very popular, this tradition, in their culture, in their history. It's part of the very fabric through which the Ethiopian history is woven. If you visit their museums, as I've done, you see it's depicted very often. There are many depictions of King Shlomo and Melech Shlomo and Malkat Shva, the Queen of Sheba, in their folk art. On my most recent trip, I visited the National Museum. That's where Lucy is, by the way. A lot of interesting things there. The museum could use a little bit of a makeover. It's not preserved very well, but okay, no. But there you see a lot of folk art, and again, depictions of Shlomo and Malkat Shva, King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. And they have all sorts of interesting stories of how he lured her and seduced her, and it's in these pictures. Again, you know, we don't have any of these traditions. All we have is what is described in Sefer Melachim and Sefer Divrei Hayamim. And there's no description of a child that they had together. But according to this one tradition, they had a child, and that child becomes Menelik I, the first great king of Ethiopia, of Solomonic dynasty, who then returns to visit his father, comes to Jerusalem, and then returns back to Ethiopia with all sorts of gifts and Jewish servants who then become the Jewish community. Again, that's one tradition. Another more popular tradition as to how the Jews of Ethiopia, or how the community began in Ethiopia, is that the Jews of Ethiopia are the descendants of the tribe of Dan, one of the 10 lost tribes conquered by Sanherib, the king of Ashur, in the 8th century BCE. And I'm sure you've all heard this before, that the Ethiopian community claims to be descendants from the tribe of Dan, one of the 10 lost tribes. Now, we know, it's described in Sefer Melachim, that after the death of Shlomo HaMelech, the kingdom was split. We had the southern kingdom, or the kingdom of Yehuda, which consisted of the tribes of Yehuda and Benjamin. But then we had a civil war, and the kingdom was split, and some decided to follow Rechavam, the son and successor of Shlomo, as their king. That was Yehuda and Benjamin. And then Yeravam, as Chazal explained, his name itself expresses that he caused a reeve, a fight, or a splinter in the Am, in the nation. Okay, he proclaims himself king, and you have Malchut Yisrael, the northern kingdom, or the kingdom of Israel. So there's this split, as you know. around mid-10th century BCE, following the death of Melech Shlomo. And then in the 8th century BCE, Sancherev, the king of Ashur, comes and conquers the northern kingdom, exiling the 10 tribes. And that's why we have what's called the 10 lost tribes. And this was his policy. It was a scorched earth policy of scattering peoples and displacing nations so they could not rise up and rebel against him. You have the Mishnah in the fourth perek of Masechet Yedayim say, Allah Sancherev Melech Ashur, this expression in the Mishnah, Sancherev came up, Ubilbelet Kol Ha'umot, and he confused all the nations. You have this expression scattered throughout the Talmud, Bilbelet Kol Ha'umot, Bilbelet Ha'olam, that Sancherev came and he mixed up and scattered different nations. Okay? And again, this was to prevent people from rising up and rebelling against him. The Mishnah teaches that in the context of actually something that's very relevant. We just had Shavuot, of course. The Torah says, Lo yavo amoni u'moavi b'kal Hashem, that an Ammonite, someone from the nation of Ammon or Moab, is not allowed to enter into the congregation of God. They can't marry into the Jewish people. However, as you know, Chazal explained, that's amoni velo amonit, moavi velo moavit. It applies to the men and not the women. And that's why, you know, the story of Ruth is Ruth HaMoaviyah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You're all familiar with the story. And, but the Mishnah there teaches that, you know, today we don't know how to identify the native Ammoni or the native Moavi. Okay. And the Gemara discusses that in a number of places, and the Rambam discusses that there are certain prohibitions on certain nations in our Torah, but we are not able to identify whether those are the, you know, indigenous original nations, because Sancherev came along and scattered the entire world and mixed up the entire world. And among the nations that he mixed up, in addition to Ammon and Moab, were the 10 tribes. Okay, so, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation about the Ethiopian Jewish community. There's a lot of fake news tossed about in the media. There's a lot of distortions. And even members of the religious community, from Jews, friends of mine that I've encountered, rabbis, colleagues, people are really ignorant as to the history, as to the attitudes of leading poskim. And some today question their status as Jews. Are those who made Aliyah and live here in the modern state of Israel, are they Jewish? You may have heard a number of years ago, there was a whole controversy at the Barkan winery about Ethiopian Jews that were working there, and a mashgiach who was overseeing the kashrut of the facility and raised some questions, and this was reported in the media. And people question, in addition, those who are left in Ethiopia. Are they Jewish? Are they really Jewish? They're coming on Aliyah, they're trickling in. Are they just opportunists looking for a better life here in the state of Israel, trying to escape poverty and difficult economic and social situations in Africa? Okay, so what's missing from the conversation is some important history and background, and that's what I hope to explore together with you this morning. So the earliest written record of a Jewish community in Ethiopia is the 9th century work, Sefer Eldad Hadani. Okay? Eldad Hadani, literally from Dan, documents his travels throughout North Africa and the Mediterranean, visiting communities, weaving tales, and teaching unique halachot. What's interesting, some of the halachot that he teaches are actually cited by many of the important Rishonim. He claims to come from a powerful, independent Jewish kingdom in East Africa, comprised of the descendants of the lost tribes of Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. He mentions other lost tribes, their whereabouts and histories. He makes reference to B'nai Moshe, the son of Moshe Rabbeinu, also residing in Africa. And according to Eldad, the Jews of Ethiopia are indeed the descendants of the tribe of Dan. So this is really the first recorded account or testimony that the Jews of Ethiopia are the descendants of the tribe of Dan. And following his visit to the Jewish community of Cairo and Tunisia, the community sends a letter to Rav Tzemach Gon of Sura, in Bavel, one of the leading poskim of the day, so to speak, to rule on whether they can accept Eldad's testimony. And Rav Tzemach Gaon replies that indeed his account is reliable, as are the halachot that he teaches. Nevertheless, in his commentary to Shmot Perek Bet, the Ibn Ezra questions the veracity of the accounts in Sefer Eldad Hadani. The Maharam Rotenberg too expresses his reservations in his tshuvot. But yet, Eldad, as I mentioned, is cited by some of the leading Rishonim, cited by Rashi, the Ravid, Rabbi Moshe, the Rajba, the Smag, Avram ben Arambam, among others, as a reputable source. Later authorities, too, would rely on his testimony and also quote the unique halachot that he taught. Some even call him rabbi. Okay, now fast forward a few centuries to the 12th century, and you have travelers like Binyamin of Tudela and Prester John, both record the presence of a Jewish community in Ethiopia. Okay, so they're not dealing with the halachic issues. Are they Jews? Aren't they Jews? But they're at least attesting to the fact that there was a Jewish community. So we know so far from the 9th century, we have a record, and then the 12th century. Okay, then in the 15th century, Rav Avadya Mibartanura, who's famous for his commentary on the Mishnah, the Bartanura writes a letter to his father, dated the 6th of Elul, 5248, August 15th, 1488, where he reports that while in Egypt, he sees dark-skinned Jews from Ethiopia who lacked the knowledge of the oral tradition, the Torah Sheba'al Peh. They only had a Torah Shebichtav. And in a subsequent letter, the following year, on the 27th of Elul, 5249, August 24th, 1489, he reports that he met some Yemenite Jews in Jerusalem who confirmed that, yes, there are indeed Jews in Ethiopia beyond the river Sambation. What is this river Sambation? So he's alluding to the rabbinic tradition. The Gemara mentions that that is the place where the 10 lost tribes were exiled. They were exiled beyond the river Sambation. It's a river that only rests on Shabbat. But what can you do? You can't travel on Shabbat. This Tchum Shabbat, right? The rest of the week, it's a river that is flowing with dangerous rocks. Okay, yeah, whatever Chazal mean by that statement, but they're trying to express the fact that we don't know where they are and it's impossible for them to return. And we'll come back to that because there are a number of different traditions as to what actually happened to the 10 lost tribes and will they end up returning and how will they end up returning if they indeed will. But you have the Bartanura writing in the 15th century, again, attesting to the fact that there's a Jewish presence in Ethiopia. Again, some scholars debate exactly how they got there. Maybe they came much later. Maybe they were Jews from Ethiopia Jews from Egypt that made their way to Ethiopia much later. But again, as I said, the two major traditions, two most popular traditions, one is either they're the descendants of the servants of Menelik or they are the descendants of the tribe of Dan. In any case, we have throughout the medieval period and into the modern period, testimony of a Jewish presence in Ethiopia. Writing in the 16th century, the Radbaz, Rabbi David ibn Shlomo ibn Zimra, the major, major achronim, wrote thousands of tshuvot. He was a rabbi in Egypt and then in Eretz Israel, in Jerusalem, and Tzfat. He sat on the Beit Din of the Beit Yosef, of Yosef Karo. The Radbaz is considered to be one of the major, major achronim, major poskim of the 16th century. And he writes a number of tshuvot, at least three tshuvot, where he mentions Jews in Ethiopia. He accepts the testimony of Eldad Hadani to be accurate and authentic. Okay, and these become very, very important tshuvot, as we'll see in just a moment. So he's emphatic that the Jews of Ethiopia are unquestionably of Jewish lineage according to halacha. Okay, so he minces no words. He is paskening, by the way. The other accounts that I mentioned, they are describing a Jewish community. They are affirming a tradition. they add to the historical record. They are accounts, but the Radbaz is paskin, okay, in three tshuvot that the Jews of Ethiopia are unquestionably of Jewish lineage according to halacha. And that's going to become very important. A student of the Radbaz, Rav Yaakov Castro, issues a similar ruling in his tshuvot, okay, in Erech Lechem, to Yoridea. And if you're interested in the tshuvot HaRadbaz, they can be found in the fourth chelek and in the seventh chelek of the Radbaz. And the Radbaz wrote thousands of tshuvot. So if anyone's interested in looking at the exact tshuvot, I can email them to you. Fast forward, again, a number of centuries, and in the late 19th century and early 20th centuries, Christian missionary groups begin to aggressively target the Jewish community in Ethiopia for conversion. This is something we know, that the Europeans begin going over to Africa, Echlal, and converting Africans to Christianity. You encounter this French and British and Italian missionaries. But what's fascinating is you have these missionaries like Samuel Gobat, John Martin Flad, Henry Aaron Stern, all writing about their attempts to convert the Jewish community of Ethiopia. And so they document their missionary activities during this period in these books that they would later publish. And I've seen these tracts. They can be found in the National Library here in Jerusalem. I've sat in the National Library and gone through some of these little tracts. And it's fascinating. They're bragging how they are successfully missionizing Jews in Ethiopia, what is now Eritrea and northern Ethiopia. And one of the tactics that they used was, during years of starvation, they gave them land in exchange for their conversion. So, you know, it's a whole discussion about how sincere their conversion was. In addition, and we'll revisit this a little bit later this morning, even those who did convert to Christianity, they lived isolated. They were never fully accepted by Ethiopian society, by their fellow Christians, quote unquote. Yes, once a Jew, always a Jew, right? Yisrael, afal pi shechata Yisrael, who a Jew, once he is a Jew, he's always a Jew. Can't convert. But they were never fully accepted. They always lived isolated. So even though there were some, and we'll talk about the nuances of the community and sort of the distinction between what we call the Beta Israel and the Falashmura, but even though there were many who converted to Christianity, they always lived apart and lived isolated. Interestingly, it wasn't because they necessarily didn't want to assimilate. The Jews wanted to assimilate, but the Christians would never accept them. We'll come back to that a little later on this morning. But so in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, you have this aggressive attempt at missionizing the Jews of Ethiopia, converting the Jews of Ethiopia, and at the same time, there's a renewed interest in the plight of the Jews of Ethiopia by the Jews of Europe. And in 1864, Rav Azriel Hildesheimer, who, of course, founded and led the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, a great yeshiva and academic institution in Berlin, Azriel Hildesheimer, in 1864, issues a call to action to counter this missionary activity. And later in 1908, there's a letter signed by 43 of the most prominent rabbis of Israel and the diaspora, which encouraged the Jews of Ethiopia to be steadfast in their faith, not to give in, not to convert. And visits to Ethiopia by Jewish scholars and educators followed. So already in the early 20th century, we have rabbis and educators and scholars going to Ethiopia, visiting and teaching. And this leads to what I would say is a renaissance in Ethiopia, okay, in the Ethiopian Jewish community, a renaissance of Torah and connection to their co-religionists abroad, but specifically in Eretz Yisrael. In 1912, Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, then chief rabbi, of pre-state Israel, pre-state Palestine, wrote a letter expressing his sincere support in sending teachers to Ethiopia to educate the community and combat the assimilation and missionary activities. If you want to see it, it's in the second chelek of the Igrot HaRa'aya, okay, of his collected letters. And following the founding of the State of Israel, the status of Ethiopian Jews would once again be discussed and debated to determine whether they would be eligible to immigrate under Israel's law of return. So now we're fast forwarding a number of decades. In 1951, then Chief Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi Herzog was asked by the Jewish agency, Sochnut, to rule on the status of Ethiopian Jewry. So he consults with historians and sociologists and anthropologists. He wants to understand the historical background. In addition to the halachic implications, okay, that's important. A posek has to be both fluent in the halacha, but also in the mitziyut, in the reality, when rendering psak halacha, when making a decision. And in a letter written in 1954, you see, Herzog didn't just quickly shoot off a tshuva, he devoted a lot of time to this question. So in a letter written in 1954, Herzog debates their pedigree and, due to a number of concerns, concludes that indeed they would require conversion. Now, part of Herzog's hesitation was a concern for mamzerut. This is very important. He wasn't the first one to raise the issue of mamzerut. The Radbaz already touches on this. Herzog was concerned that since the community did not have the same Torah Sheba'al Peh and Gemara, as we do, they had some form of Torah Sheba'al Peh as to how to interpret their Torah, but they didn't have the same Torah Sheba'al Peh as we did. It was lost subsequently. They weren't successful at preserving it. It wasn't written down. So while their marriages may be considered valid kiddushin, as you have men and women living together as husband and wife, and there's a question whether that itself can create kiddushin, can create a marriage, whether that's considered kiddushin, but they did not perform gittin, which creates serious concerns regarding mamzerut, because if indeed, by living together, they are married, should they subsequently separate and the woman marries another man, well, if he never gave her a get, they were never divorced. She was never divorced from her first husband. She's considered an ishet ish. And then if she subsequently has another child with her new husband, again, serious concerns regarding mamzerut. The child would be a mamzer. So this is a real question. Now, the truth is, if you speak to the community, they will tell you that, what, divorce? In other words, divorce really didn't exist in their community. So this was not much of a concern for them, but this was a concern for the poskim. Who knows if among them there are mamzerim? And conversion to Judaism would wipe clean any potential problems with lineage or pedigree or mamzerut. If you rule that they are not Jewish and need to undergo a conversion, so it's a clean slate, it's a tabula rasa in the language of John Locke, right? You no longer have to worry about mamzerut, okay? So that point is important because perhaps that very point influenced Rav Herzog's psak, influenced his ruling. In addition, he also, based on the information that he got from historians and anthropologists, he may have come to believe that they were not descendants of the tribe of Dan. Okay, he did not accept the testimony of Eldad Hadani. Fast forward about 20 years, almost 20 years later, Ravad Yosef rules that the Beta Israel, the group which clung most strongly to their faith for thousands of years, should be accorded full halachic status as Jews. Now, where did Rav Herzog and Ravad Yosef differ? Okay, so again, Rav Herzog ruled that they would need to undergo conversion, which would influence, the current position, let's say, of the chief rabbinate. But Rav Ovadia Yosef, he accepted the testimony of Eldad Hadani as accepted by the Radbaz. Kedarko Bakodesh, Rav Avadya Yosef, you know, would look at what the majority of the poskim have to say on an issue, goes through sugya, of course, goes through the Rishonim, goes through the Achronim, and sees what the majority, or how the majority rule. So Rav Avad Yosef, Kedarko Bakodesh, accepts the ruling of the Radbaz, as he does in many places. Okay. Now again, the Radbaz seems to accept the testimony of Eldad Hadani without question, which is interesting, because no, you could ask the question, you know, why? It's not clear from the Tshuvot of the Radbaz why he is so willing to just accept this testimony of Eldad Hadani, but perhaps he saw how Eldad is quoted by all the Rishonim, as I've mentioned already. And, you know, perhaps that gives weight or credence or legitimacy to his testimony. And so the Radbaz very willingly accepts the testimony of Eldad Hadani. And so Rav Avadya Yosef, you know, he basically just gives his gushpanka, his stamp of approval, on the piske halacha of the Radbaz. And Rav Avadya Yosef's ruling set in motion a chain of events that would change the government's attitude and policy towards Ethiopia's Jews, eventually leading to the dramatic airlifts of Operation Moses and Solomon. And in 1975, the Beta Israel community was officially recognized as Jewish by the State of Israel under the Law of Return. And in 1977, they began to arrive as Olim. Rav Avadya writes a subsequent tshuva in 1985. If you're interested, it's in Yabia Omer, Evan Ha'ezer, Chelek Chet, the eighth volume of Evan Ha'ezer, Siman Yud Aleph there. And he writes that, you know, at the time when he initially was asked, he didn't want to defer from the authority of Rav Herzog, but he did not agree. So now he's coming out clear and strong. And he writes that, you know, the Bet Israel, he calls them the Falashes. We'll come back to that in a moment. We have to make a distinction between really two different communities among Ethiopian Jewry. He writes that the Falashes, but he means the Bet Israel, are Jews in every respect. They do not need a conversion, even out of stringency. Okay? And many, many accepted the ruling of Rav Avadya Yosef. Many members of the Ethiopian community accepted the ruling of Rav Avadya Yosef. They, because of his involvement with their community, they saw him as their posek. They adopted him as their posek. And so many who were part of, or are part of, the Beta Israel, the first community that comes over, they did not undergo conversion. Some of them subsequently would undergo conversion, maybe just a pro forma, quickie conversion to rule out any sfeikot. Maybe before they got married, they would take a dip in the mikvah, different things, you know, maybe they're marrying into a non-Ethiopian family. So some underwent a conversion, but many didn't, and they followed Rav Avadya Yosef. Now, what he calls the Falasha are the Beta Israel. This is, as I mentioned, the community that clung most strongly to their tradition and did not convert to Christianity. This was a community that lived isolated in villages in northern Ethiopia and in what is today Eritrea. They would, if they came into contact with a Gentile, they would immerse in a river, okay? They would not allow a Gentile to come into their home. If they came into contact, they felt that they were tamei, they had become impure somehow, so they would go and immerse in a mikvah, in a river. They did not have interactions with non-Jews, and they suffered tremendously and made tremendous sacrifices, and they did not give in, and they did not convert, okay? Then there is this other community that is called the Falashmura, which is a derogatory term. And by the way, the Beta Israel community sees the Falashmura as bugdim, as rebels, so to speak. This is the community that did give in and did convert. Either they were forcibly converted, either they converted out of pressure, they were starving to death and they were given, you know, farmlands, fields. It's not so clear. But as I already mentioned, nevertheless, this community lived isolated. They had their own villages. And from the elders of the Ethiopian community that I've met with and spoken with, they'll tell me that it's not because they didn't want to assimilate into the greater Ethiopian culture, but the Ethiopian culture would not allow them to assimilate. Even though they had converted to Christianity, you know, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, they were never fully accepted. They were not allowed to integrate. They were not allowed to marry. Some did, but intermarriage was very rare. The elders of the community have told me they had all sorts of, their neighbors had all sorts of names for them. They called them hyenas. I guess hyena is a very, you know, derogatory term. You know, it's like, a wild animal. And they never accepted them. And even to this day, those Jews that are still there in Ethiopia, in Addis, the nation's capital, and Gondar in the north, they suffer tremendously from their neighbors. And I'll come back to that in a little later on this morning. So Rav Avadia ruled that they did not need to go through a conversion, even l'chumrah, okay, even out of stringency, even a giur l'chumrah. So that's interesting. Other poskim disagreed. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Eliezer of Waldenburg, major posek, wrote thousands of tshuvot as well. He was the posek of Shari Tzedek Hospital, one of the great poskim here in Yerushalayim. So he has a tshuva in the 17th chelek of the Tzitz Eliezer, many, many chalakim, many tshuvot in the Tzitz Eliezer, where he quotes the position of Rav Shach and Rav Eliyashiv and Rav Shlomo Zalman Arabach and Diane Weiss, Yitzchak Weiss, that they all, Minchas Yitzchak, they all required that the community undergo conversion. And they felt that it was a requirement, that it wasn't even l'chumra, but that it was a requirement. Okay? And for decades, the official position of the chief rabbinate was that the Beta Israel have a strong presumptive status as Jews, but they require a conversion to rule out any doubts and any sveikot, a giur l'chumrah. Again, this is for the Beta Israel. Recently, the chief rabbinate has reaffirmed that ruling, okay, that again, because of some recent events here in Israel and because of the hopefully impending aliyah of the rest of the community, you know, this issue has come up. So they've recently reaffirmed this ruling, but again, this is about the Beta Israel, not the Falashmura. The Falashmura, the community that converted to Christianity, while they are descendants of the same group as the Beta Israel, they will descend from the same group, but since they have converted to Christianity, so that community requires a full conversion, not just the Giur L'chumrah, but a full conversion, which is performed. And by the way, there are rabbis that are visiting the community and performing conversions even now. Okay, maybe we'll come back to that if we have some time later on this morning. But I wanted to look together with you at a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Okay, so in terms of the contemporary poskim, the contemporary decisors of Jewish law, Rav Avadia Yosef ruled that the Beta Israel do not need conversion, even l'chumrah. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Shach, Rav Eliyashiv, Rav Shlomo Zalman Arabach, Diane Weiss, required that they did need a conversion. I want to take a look together with you at a fascinating tshuva of Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe Feinstein actually has two tshuvot where he addresses the community. He also rules that they require conversion, but I want to show you what he writes because it's so important. It's so important to understand how we should approach this community because, as I mentioned at the beginning, you know, I've encountered many religious Jews who say, oh, are they even Jewish? Are they descendants of Jews? Or are they just, you know, Africans trying to jump on the bandwagon? They're opportunists just trying to take advantage of a better life here. They want to escape poverty and all sorts of things in Ethiopia. All sorts of poor conditions. And even rabbis and colleagues of mine who've questioned my involvement with the Jewish community and my work with the Jewish community in Ethiopia abroad, the community that's still there waiting to make aliyah, and the Jewish community here, they've questioned my work. You know, Nadel, why are you getting involved with them? So I want to show you a very important tshuva from Rav Moshe Feinstein, which I think really, really informs our discussion and what should be our attitude towards the Jewish community of Ethiopia. Okay, one second, let's see. Share screen. Source sheets, share. Okay, so can you all see the source sheets? Not if you can see the source sheets. Okay, yeah. This is a tshuva that appears in Igrot Moshe, Eben Ezer Chelek Hey, the fifth volume of Eben Ezer. And it was written to his grandson of Mordechai Tendler. Okay, so as I said, this is one of two tshuvot that Rav Moshe writes, where he concludes that they require conversion. He writes the following. He mentions the Radbaz, which we've already mentioned this morning, how the Radbaz accepts the testimony of Eldad HaDani, and the Radbaz rules that the Jews of Ethiopia are indeed Jews. So where I've underlined, Rav Moshe writes, Aval ledina kashe lismoch al zeh. But ledina, according to halacha, halachically speaking, it's difficult to rest upon this, to accept this. Okay, it's difficult to rely on this, right? Shelo barur im haradbaz yada hetev hamitziut odotam. Because it's not clear that the Radbaz really understood the mitziut, the parameters, the situation, the facts on the ground. The Radbaz, as I mentioned, accepts the testimony of Eldad HaDani willingly. But Rav Moshe questions that. You know, it's not clear what the motivations of the Radbaz was. But he, I guess, as I said, maybe he sees how the Rishonim had already accepted Eldad. So he too accepts Eldad. But Rav Moshe writes, you know, we can't necessarily rely on this, halachically speaking. The gamo barur im ad zmanenu lo nishtane matzavam. And this is also an important point. It's also not clear if until today their situation has not changed. Meaning, since the Radbaz, who's writing in the 16th century and rules that the Jews of Ethiopia should be considered Jews and, again, do not require conversion or are full-fledged Jews according to halacha. So, you know, it's not clear, number one, what influenced the decision of the Radbaz, and if he really understood the facts on the ground. And number two, it's not clear if the situation has changed. It's possible that from the 16th century to the 20th century, the situation has changed. And maybe the community that's there in the 20th century, when Rav Moshe is writing, is not the same community that the Radbaz was talking about. Okay, so he has a number of sfeikot. And because of these sfeikot, Rav Moshe rules that the community has to undergo a conversion. Okay? And here, in the next paragraph, where I've underlined, he writes the following. Ulegabei yahadutam, concerning their Judaism, nechshav lanu kisafek. It's a doubt. It's a doubt concerning their Judaism. V'yesh lahatzricham gerut amiti, kodem she natiram lavo bikahal. And he writes, therefore, we must require a true, complete conversion before they are allowed to enter into the community, meaning before they can marry into the Jewish community. Aval gam kodem gerutam yesh mitzvah. This is important. I put this in bold because this is crucial. This is so important. Aval gam kodem gerutam yesh mitzvah lahatzilam mishmad umisakana kidin kol Yisrael. Incredible. Even before they convert, we have a mitzvah, he writes, to save them, to protect them from shmad, from conversion, and from danger, to save their lives. Rav Moshe is writing this during a tremendous famine. We know that in the 70s and 80s, there was tremendous famine, famine that would topple governments in Ethiopia. So we have to save them from danger, kidin kol Yisrael, like any Jew. Like we have a mitzvah to save any Jew. Shesafek nefashot lahakel. Because when it comes to pikuach nefesh, saving life, we say safek nefashot lahakel. If there's a doubt, we err on the side of caution. And we are mekil. Gam shekan hasafek havei be'etzem yichusam ki yudim. Even though here we're talking, what is the safek? The safek is concerning their very essence, their very status as Jews, right? Nevertheless, we still have to save them, he writes. And this would mean feed them. This would mean bring them on Aliyah, okay? Even if we have all sorts of doubts, are they Jews, aren't they Jews? So anyone who questions, well, are they Jews, aren't they Jews? You know, maybe they're just taking advantage of the situation. Again, Rav Moshe writes very clearly, we have a mitzvah to save them. Incredible point he makes here. And even if, halachically, they're not Jews, right? Let's play devil's advocate. Even according to the opinion that maybe they're not Jews, technically. Mikol makom, nevertheless, me'achar shechoshdim shehem yudim, u'mosrim nafshama yudam, mechuyavim lahatzilam. An incredible statement. Since they identify as Jews, since they consider themselves Jews, since they think of themselves as Jews and have given up their lives for their Judaism, their moser nefesh, they've sacrificed so much, sacrificed tremendously, and continue to sacrifice, I will add, we are obligated, Rav Moshe writes, to save them. This is an incredible statement. An incredible statement. And then he continues and makes another very, very important point. And this point really goes beyond our discussion this morning and touches on what's happening in the world today and what's happening in the United States right now. He says, "Umeod nitzta'arti." I'm very deeply saddened. Al mash shamati sheyesh ke'elu be'eretz Yisrael shimonim milekarvam be'inyanei ruchaniyut v'gormim chas v'shalom shiyu avudim midat Yehudi. I'm very saddened to hear that there are those in Israel that are not accepting of them, that are preventing them from being drawn close spiritually, and are chas v'shalom, heaven forbid, creating a situation where they are being lost to Judaism. And this, of course, is a situation that we've seen. This is a situation that we've seen. Unfortunately, the Jews who've come on Aliyah, whether it was Operation Moses or Solomon or Joshua, or those who have trickled in recent years, we know that Israel, unfortunately, has failed them in many ways, including spiritually. After one of my trips to Ethiopia, I came back and was speaking to a colleague who teaches at a yeshiva that's located in Mevaser Tzion, where there's a Merkaz Klita, an absorption center, and a lot of Ethiopian Jews live there. And, you know, he said to me, "Yeah, but, you know, I see these Ethiopian Jews and I see how they act and they're on the street and they, you know, are they really Jews and how they're behaving? And, you know, once they're here, they're not living as Jews, as Orthodox Jews." I said to him, "Well, you know, whose fault is that? This is a community that for almost 3,000 years clung to their tradition, to their Orit, and made tremendous sacrifices. And then they come here and they're wandering around the streets. Well, whose fault is that?" We'll come back to that in just a moment. But Rav Moshe continues and writes, and I put this in bold because it's so important. It touches on what's going on here and abroad. It's possible that the reason why people are not reaching out to them and people are not embracing them is because their skin color is black. The color of their skin is black. Simply, we are obligated to draw them close, to bring them in. Lo rak mitzad she'enam gruyim mishar yehudim, not just because they're any, you know, worse than any other Jews. Ve'ein ledina chiluk b'ma shehem shchorim. This is very, very important. It is, according to halacha, there's no distinction that they're dark-skinned, they're black. Jewish law doesn't give weight to the color of one's skin as to their status as Jews. We don't make a distinction between skin color. We don't say because his skin color is white, he's more Jewish than he. Okay? So that's a very important point. Because in the wake of the events going on right now in the United States, I've seen black Jews living in the United States and elsewhere talking about their experiences and their encounters with racism as members of the Jewish community, being black, being black-skinned. Okay. He makes another point. He says, we have a mitzvah to love the convert. He says, I think people are distancing them because maybe they, you know, went through some sort of conversion. He says, just the opposite. We have a mitzvah to love the convert. Okay, so Rav Moshe is very disturbed by what he sees, and he makes two very important points. He says, number one, yes, there exists a number of doubts. There are a number of doubts as to their status as Jews. Nevertheless, we are obligated, he writes, it's a mitzvah to help them, to save them, to protect them, to bring them on aliyah. Okay, even while there is, or while there exists doubts, because when it comes to doubt in halacha, we say safek nefeshet lahakel. We err on the side of caution. We have a mitzvah to save life, even if we're in doubt as to, you know, as to the situation, and even if this doubt is, you know, not concerning, even if this doubt is, as he writes, concerning their very identity as Jews, their very status as Jews. Okay, we have a mitzvah, and even he says, let's say they're not Jews, but because they consider themselves Jews for generations, and because they are moser nefesh, they've sacrificed so much, we have an obligation to save them. Mechuyavim lahatzilam, writes. And then he continues and says, no, don't be confused and think that because the color of their skin is black, you shouldn't draw them close. Chas v'shalom. Halacha makes no distinction with regards to skin color. A black Jew is just as much of a Jew as any other Jew. And we have a mitzvah to love the convert. Don't push them away because they're undergoing conversion. Chas v'shalom. Okay? So the community that remains today in Ethiopia numbers approximately 7,500 souls. There are about 1,500 in the capital, Addis Ababa, and another 6,000 in Gondar in the north. And they sit and wait while the government of Israel reaches a final decision regarding their immigration. The community that's there today is the Falash Mura. As I mentioned, they are the descendants of those forced or pressured to convert to Christianity. And they are currently living as sincere practicing Jews and will undergo a full conversion either prior to making Aliyah or upon making Aliyah. Okay, we'll come back to that in a moment. As I mentioned, it's a romantic story. It's a dramatic story, right? It's the story of their dramatic return home. In the 1970s, they began walking by foot through the Sudan towards Israel. It's estimated that over 4,000 died on the journey, men, women, and children, from starvation, from thirst, from exhaustion, and from violence against them. They walked through the Sudan with the plan of coming up through Egypt because they have this tradition that they had followed the source of the Nile from Israel to Egypt, down through the Nile, down to Ethiopia, and that's the way they were going to return to Israel. And they started making their way in the 1970s because of the famine and the political unrest and the violence. And so that was when Israel began these heroic airlifts and these heroic rescue missions. So first we had Operation Moses, which were these covert evacuations between November 1984 and January 1985. And it was this operation where Israel evacuated about 8,000 Jews from refugee camps in Sudan. They rescued them, again, about 8,000 on 30 flights over the course of 7 weeks. And once the Sudanese learned of it, you know, all of a sudden here you have all of these Israelis landing in Israel. And so it stopped abruptly on January 5th, and there were those who were left behind. And so in 1985, the U.S. carried out Operation Joshua, which brought another 650 to Israel. But the most dramatic and heroic airlift was in 1991, Operation Solomon. Sure, all of you have seen the images. There was instability again in the region. And fearing Ethiopia's government was about to be toppled, and the concern was really that it could be devastating for the Jewish community and that those who were left would never be able to get out. So in two days, Israel, I mean, it's just an incredible, incredible story. In 36 hours, Israel airlifted 14,325 Ethiopian Jews. Okay, from May 24th to May 25th, 1991, they ran 35 nonstop flights of Israeli aircraft, including Israeli Air Force C-130s and El Al Boeing 747s. And they transported over 14,000 people. Imagine 14,000 people in a period of 36 hours. Only we Israelis could have the chutzpah to try something like that. And as I mentioned, they used El Al's aircraft as well. They had to pull out all the seating to make room for the people. There were children born en route. Right? So for those of you who complain about El Al, okay, imagine what those flights were like then in 1991. You know, imagine what the legroom was like. But for those of you who complain about El Al, they have a tremendous zchut in bringing over 14,000 Ethiopian Jews together with the Israeli Air Force. And in recent decades since, la'at la'at, slowly, slowly, olim have trickled into Israel. And those initial airlifts were the Beit Israel community. The subsequent olim have been from the Falash Mura. I remember I was once leading a group of high schoolers on a summer program, a teen tour, summer teen tour for students, high school students from the United States, well, North America, United States and Canada. And we landed at the airport. This must have been in the late 90s. We landed at the airport and we're exiting the terminal, going up to our buses, boarding our buses. And we see hundreds of Ethiopians who had just gotten there, boarding their buses. Okay, it's incredible. So in recent years, the community has slowly trickled in. But today, as I mentioned, there are about 7,500 that are still waiting to make Aliyah. In 2015, November of 2015, the Knesset, they decided, they ruled that they were going to bring the rest of the Jews from Ethiopia home, but that has not yet been implemented. Why? A lot of different reasons. In October 2018, on one of my trips while I was there, literally as my plane hit the tarmac, as my plane touched down, Netanyahu announced in October 2018 that he was going to bring the rest home. But then, you know, they dragged their feet and went into elections and more elections and even more elections, as you all know. And nothing has really happened. Likud made a lot of promises during the elections. Over the past few months, there have been, a few that have trickled in. In 2018, by the way, Netanyahu promised that 1,000 would come. Okay, and there were just a few hundred that ended up coming. And then subsequently, over the past few months, there have been pockets that have come in, just really tens of olim, not many at all. But, altogether since October 2018, maybe just several hundred. There's still many that are waiting. And it's very sad. It's very sad. If you visit Ethiopia and you visit the Jewish community there, you see that the community there is really suffering. They live in really awful conditions. These were people that were living in rural farming villages in northern Ethiopia and in what is today Eritrea. And they gave up everything in recent decades and moved to these major cities, major population centers, Addis and Gondar in the north, in order to make Aliyah. And so they gave up their farms and they gave up their homes and they live in squalor and they live in refugee camps and very poor conditions, really in hovels with no access to proper medical care. And they're starving and they're suffering. And you hear stories of how their children are kidnapped and held for ransom by their neighbors, how when white Jews come and visit with them and visit them by their homes, their landlords will raise the rent on them, will try and take advantage of them. I've heard stories from the young people of how they're beaten up at school. This is the day-to-day reality that they live with. And people question their sincerity. Are they opportunists? Are they taking advantage of the situation? They've really given up everything. They right now struggle with so many economic and social challenges that they face. The question, are they really Jewish? So you have to go and visit and watch them pray. And I'll show you just in a moment some scenes from what Jewish life is like on a typical Sunday in Addis Ababa at the Jewish community there at the Jewish Community Center in Tikvat Zion, their shul, in the middle of Addis Ababa in the Yekka neighborhood, very close to the Israeli embassy. The Israeli embassy, by the way, is so large, it's blocks long, but I've spoken to the community there many times, and the embassy doesn't really do anything for them today, unfortunately. The community has really been neglected. It's so sad to watch. Besides for this one rabbi who's really supporting the community spiritually and physically even, and financially, there's no one that's really doing anything for the community. Israel has really neglected them. And this one rabbi sends young people from Israel to go and teach the community and teach them Hebrew and, you know, go on shlichut. It's very impressive to see. So I met on one of my visits this young couple from Efrat, a newly married couple that spent about a half a year there. And they told me the saddest story of how before they left, there was a mother who came and begged them to take their daughter, to take her young daughter, her child, with them back to Israel. She said, I can't care for her. I don't have anything for her. I can't, you know. It's just the most heartbreaking stories you hear. So people question their sincerity. This is a people who've given up everything and in recent decades have rejoined the Jewish people and are learning. And you'll see in a moment footage that I shot how they're on a Sunday coming to the shul there and learning Torah. And, you know, they live scattered across the city, but on Sundays they can come and have the time and they sit there and they study and they learn Hebrew and prepare for their aliyah and learn Torah. It's pretty incredible to watch. And you'll also see a tapestry, it's an embroidery really, that hangs on the wall of the synagogue with names of those who've died waiting to make aliyah. The first time I saw it, you know, hundreds of names. The first time I saw it, I thought it was, you know, those some 4,000 Jews who died walking through the Sudan en route to Israel. But no, I was told, no, these are just people who were living here in Addis, members of the community who died while waiting in recent decades. So, you know, they are suffering, and yet they continue to cling to their hope and longing. They want nothing more to come home and to be a part of the story that's taking place here in the modern state of Israel. You'll see a community that's deeply committed to the Torah of Israel, the people of Israel, the land of Israel, and they're just waiting to reunite with their family and their ancestral homeland. Sayna domeh shmiya l'ri'iya. There's nothing like seeing it with your own eyes. So far, our last few minutes this morning, I'll show you some footage that I took, and I hope you'll all be able to see it on your screens and hear it as well. Now, please let me know if you're able to hear it as well.
It's a sunny Sunday morning here in Addis.
Can you hear the audio?
I just finished Shacharit, the morning prayers. It was so meaningful and moving and inspiring to pray together with over 200 men, women, and children, people of all ages, praying in a mix of Hebrew, Amharic, and speaking to God from their heart in their own way. But people often ask, Rabbi, are there even Jews in the field? So I'd like to take you on a tour of what Jewish life is like here in Addis Ababa. Hundreds of men, women, and children. This is the synagogue. Look how many people are here coming to pray to study Torah on a Sunday morning. Hundreds of men, women, and children. Notice that the synagogue is really very temporary. It's almost a shed. I hope that I'll soon return. Something you can hear me. The synagogue, in fact, is called Tikvat Zion, hope of Zion, to return to Israel and Jerusalem. Here on the wall hangs a list of names in English and in Amharic. Those who died waiting to come on Aliyah to Israel. When I first saw this, I thought perhaps names of some 4,000 died walking on foot through the Sudan. Disease, hunger and thirst, and violence. But no, these are names of men, women, and children who died here in Addis, waiting to come on Aliyah, just over the past 20 years. It's a community that's really left everything, sacrificed everything to be here. They left their homes in rural farming villages throughout Ethiopia to come to population centers in Addis and in Gondar in the north. To wait to make Aliyah, it's not been an easy process. They suffer all sorts of social and economic challenges here. Anyone who questions the sincerity or the Jewishness of these people need but just come here and see that this is a community that is madly in love with the One Above, madly in love with the God of Israel, the Torah of Israel, the people of Israel, the land of Israel, and the state of Israel. Just waiting to come home. What's fascinating is if you speak to them, you see that many of them have family members, immediate family, already come on Aliyah. And so many people who have children or brothers or sisters, siblings, or even parents. There's about 7,500 remaining left, 1,500 here in Addis, 6,000 up north in Gondar, waiting, praying every day to return to Zion. It's incredible to witness their longing, their passion, to feel their pain, to see their suffering. This is people really giving up everything to be here. All they want is to be part of the story. Now, take you aside. Make the trash here. This is where there are classrooms. Young people come and learn. They study Hebrew here, prepare for their Aliyah. As I said, there's even a chapter of the Akiva here. In this compound, there's also a mikvah. I'll take you to where the mikvah is. The mikvah is locked right now. The community has a mikvah for the women of the community, for those who undergo conversion while still here in Addis. Some who undergo conversion here, some who undergo conversion when we reach the state of Israel. Shalom, Yiladim! Shalomchem! Boker Tov! Shabbat Tov! Again, typical Sunday morning here in Addis Ababa, men, women, and children, people of all ages coming to serve God, to daven, to learn Torah, to the Akiva activities. And here with the group, about 25 students from the UK who brought gifts, special things for the kids, treats to give out.
They're even dancing this morning. I'm learning the traditional Ethiopian shoulder dance. It's gonna take a little more time for me to get it. How am I? Am I good? Good? Yeah.
Here, there's a class going on, and very often it's the young people of the community that are in the teaching roles, the leadership roles. Heshiv Lev Banim Alevotam, there we see a fulfillment of that prophecy here. They're learning Hebrew in preparation for their Aliyah. Many of the young people in the community speak Hebrew very well. It's amazing to see all the learning that's taking place. A lot of the young people, actually, in Midrash Hanukah of the Bnei Akiva, have been fortunate to spend time in Shivot and Midrashot in the land of Israel. Another class taking place. Again, it's the teenagers of the community that are in these teaching roles. It's incredible. Standing room only. Look how many kids packed into this class to learn Torah, to learn Hebrew, to learn about their heritage. Class for the women of the community.
Prophet Isaiah in chapter 11 promises a time when Hashem, God, will return the remnants of Israel from the land of Assyria, from the land of Egypt, from Patros, and from the land of Cush, here in Ethiopia. In our own day, we've been fortunate to witness the ingathering of the exiles from the four corners of the earth. The story is not over yet. 7,500 Jews still here in Ethiopia, suffering, struggling, waiting, yearning and longing to return home to Zion, to the land of Israel, to Jerusalem. They just want to be a part of the story. It's up to us to make that happen.
Okay, so that gives you a little glimpse into what life is like on a typical Sunday morning. And I've been there a number of times on a Sunday morning when they really come out in droves. And I'm sorry. I think now YouTube is playing another video. We'll close that down. And what I found on my visits to Ethiopia is a community deeply committed to Torah and mitzvot, sincere in their desire to join the Jewish people, waiting to return to Israel, hoping to reunite with their family and their ancestral homeland. And anyone who questions their sincerity just needs to visit Ethiopia and see for themselves, see with their own eyes. My opinion and my life has been forever changed. Now, it's not to say that things are easy here in the state of Israel. The community struggled and continues to struggle. They have not had it easy. They face all sorts of economic and social challenges. You know, there were a number of articles last year in the Makor Rishon, profiles on different very successful Ethiopians, including, or members of the Ethiopian community, including a doctor who, very, very talented doctor, who related that she's often mistaken for the cleaning staff in the hospital where she works. She's there as a doctor, but because of the color of her skin, you know, people say, oh, you know, could you clean up this room? This room needs to be cleaned. And that hurts. The fact that, unfortunately, you know, racism and discrimination exists here in the state of Israel. That's very painful, but it's a reality. You know, that just last July, there were clashes with police. There was an incident that took place on June 30th of 2019, where an off-duty police officer in Kiryat Chaim, which is a neighborhood in northern Haifa, was out with his wife and three small children. They were at some park in some playground, and there were some teenagers that were fighting, and it got violent, and the officer tried to break it up, and allegedly he fired his gun. His gun went off, and it was supposed to be fired. He claimed it, he fired at the ground to give a warning shot, but the bullet ricocheted and killed this 18-year-old member of the Ethiopian community, Solomon Teka, who died. And there was outrage, and there were, you know, over the past several years, there were a number of similar incidents, unfortunately. And in July, there were all sorts of protests and riots, and some of them even got violent. It wasn't entirely the Ethiopian community. There were opportunists who took advantage. There were anarchists and Arabs and others that used that as a platform to wreak havoc and cause violence. But you know that it has not been easy for the Jewish community here, the Ethiopian community here in the modern state of Israel. They've faced all sorts of challenges. They've struggled and they continue to struggle. Nevertheless, we pray for a day when those still waiting to make Aliyah in Ethiopia will be reunited with their brethren here in the state of Israel. I think we have a responsibility both to the Jewish community of Ethiopia that's already here to assist them and help them, as well as the remnants of the community, members of the community that are still living abroad. We have an obligation to help them as well. You know, the current policy is untenable. Baruch Hashem, if you've been watching the news, they just appointed a member of the community as the Minister of Absorption in Aliyah. So that is a positive thing, and hopefully that will lead to the subsequent Aliyah of the rest of the community. But currently the policy is really, I can't find a better word to describe the current policy rather than embarrassing. It's really embarrassing. Israel has dragged their feet, has only allowed small numbers to trickle in, and the current policy separates families. I've met many people who tell me they have parents that have been accepted for Aliyah, but for whatever reason, the grown children have not yet been accepted for Aliyah, or vice versa. You have children that are accepted for Aliyah and come on Aliyah, and the parents remain siblings, aunts, uncles. Families are split, even immediate families. And this is nothing short of cruel. The current policy is, it's embarrassing, it's cruel, it's untenable. And it's something that has to change. And Israel needs to live up to the decision of November 2015 and bring the rest of the Jews of Ethiopia on Aliyah. This is a community that's madly in love with the God of Israel and the Torah of Israel and the people of Israel. And they just want to be a part of the story that's taking place here. They just want to return. They long to return to the land, to reunite with family, to reunite with their ancestral homeland. Anyone who questions their sincerity just needs to visit Ethiopia and see for themselves. And Mirtz Hashem will see the fulfillment of the prophecy in Yeshayahu, Perek Yud Aleph, Isaiah chapter 11, where he describes that God will return the exile from among the four corners of the earth, from Egypt, from Patros, from Elam, from Shinar, from all these places, from Cush. And Cush, as I mentioned in the video, is Ethiopia. This discussion in Chazal, in the Bavli, and the Talmud Yerushalmi, if the 10 lost tribes will return, did they already return? Will they never return? There is an opinion that says they will return as righteous converts. Who knows? Maybe we are seeing the fulfillment of that prophecy in our days. So for those who say, well, why do we require them to undergo a conversion? You know, it's discrimination. No, they're returning to their people. They're returning to their faith. And, you know, maybe like Chazal say, part of the process of the ingathering of the exiles will require, you know, a conversion to rule out any questions. This is a community that has sacrificed so much, and we have a responsibility to this community. I'll take any questions. Any questions? No. Okay. Okay. You're all unmuted. If anyone has any questions. Okay, well, have a wonderful day. All the best.